Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, May 1st, 2013, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group teleform conference call. Today, we'll be discussing some of the costs of the regulatory regime. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome to our program two experts. They're both going to give us opening remarks of about 6 to 10 minutes, after which we might have a little exchange between the two of them, and then we'll spend the balance of our 60-minute call taking questions from our audience. So please be ready with your questions. I want to draw your attention to a couple things. In the notice of today's call, you received a link to a blog post and a chart that will be referred to in Susan Dudley's opening remarks. If you don't have that handy, you can see it on her website, which she'll talk about, but you can also find it on the Federalist Society's Executive Branch Project blog, and that's executivebranchproject.com. That's where you can see her blog post and her chart, which again she'll be referring to shortly. Our two experts today, Professor Susan Dudley is Director of the Regulatory Studies Center and Research Professor of Public Policy and Public Administration, the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration at the George Washington University. Importantly, for our purposes today, she's the former head of OIRA in the Office of Management and Budget. And Mr. Randall Davis is co-founder and principal of the Stuntz Davis and Staffier firm. There, he specializes in legislative and regulatory matters affecting the energy industries. In the past, he served as associate director for natural resources, energy, and science at the Office of Management and Budget. Now, their larger bios, more complete bios, have been circulated in the notice of this call, so I've been brief in my introductions. Feel free to look up their larger bios during the call if you'd like. But let's get right to the program. And with that, Ms. Dudley, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Okay. Thank you, Dean. And thanks, Randy, for being on this call, too. We're talking about OMB's report to Congress, which OMB has they've issued a report each year since 1997 on the benefits and costs of federal regulation as required by the Regulatory Right to Know Act. OMB released its draft 2013 report about a week and a half ago, but the White House has yet to reissue a press release, and you have to actually know what you're looking for to find the report on the OMB website. It's four clicks down from the main OMB page to find it. The report covers regulatory activity through the end of fiscal year 2012, so through September 30th of last year. And the results are startling. It shows that the rules issued in fiscal year 2012 alone imposed more costs on the economy than all the rules issued during the entire first terms of Presidents Bush and Clinton combined. Now, this is particularly interesting because as the presidential election approached, the White House was widely reported to be restraining the regulatory agencies out of concern for the state of the economy. Now that the results are tallied, though, there is little evidence of restraint. Now, the graph that Dean mentioned that it's on the Federalist Society website and also on the George Washington University Regulatory Studies Center website, which is regulatorystudies.gwu.edu. It shows comparisons of the first four fiscal years of this administration along with the first four fiscal years of the previous two administrations. I assembled the graph from graphs and data provided in the OMB report, which actually does not include the information needed to fill in the missing years. So I just want to make clear that the selective comparisons to the first 4 years are the administration's and not mine. If you're interested, my graph corresponds to figure 2-1 of OMB's draft report, except that OMB's graph focuses on net benefits, so it doesn't disaggregate out costs and benefits. And it combines the four-year periods into one bar for each administration. And both of these differences obfuscate the cost impact of the rules issued last year. The report does not highlight the large costs of last year's rule, but instead points to the large regulatory benefits that agencies claim will flow from them. The benefits are very different in character from the costs, however. Of the reported benefits of regulations issued in fiscal year 2012, over 95% derive from two assumptions that many scholars find questionable and that I've written about elsewhere. The first assumption is that reductions in emissions of fine particles will cause large reductions in premature mortality. And the second is that depriving consumers of their preferred choices when purchasing appliances and cars will ultimately make them better off, because the fuel savings are worth more to the consumers themselves, than consumers realize. In making the comparisons of net benefits across different administrations, the OMB report uses another questionable technique. If a court has vacated a rule issued by a previous administration, the report removes the net benefits of that rule from that administration's tally. Yet it continues to include in the current administration's tally the cross-state air pollution rule, which many of you may know as CSAPR, that was vacated last August. Since EPA claims net benefits of almost $40 billion per year for that rule, selectively taking credit for the vacated CSAPR rule clearly affects OMB's net benefits comparison. This seems particularly inappropriate because as a result of that vacature, EPA is actually enforcing the Bush administration's, also overturned but not vacated, Clean Air Interstate Rule. Now, the benefits and costs of regulations, individually and in the aggregate, are notoriously hard to measure. We don't have a mechanism like the fiscal budget for keeping track of the costs individuals and businesses spend to comply with regulations, nor of the benefits that regulation brings. OMB's annual report probably offers one of the most comprehensive estimates available on the expected benefits and costs of federal regulation, but as OMB acknowledges, it has limitations. First, the report covers a small fraction of the 3,000 to 4,000 regulations federal agencies publish each year. The 2012 estimates, for example, are based on just 14 regulations. The report does not include regulations issued by independent agencies like the SEC, the FCC, or the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It also excludes potentially high-impact regulations for which agencies did not estimate both benefits and costs. Many Affordable Care Act regulations, for example, are not included for this reason. Furthermore, the reported benefits and costs are based on ex-ante estimates developed by the agencies themselves before the regulations went into effect. So while the report provides useful information about regulatory impacts and trends, we should recognize that it's but one measure of the effects of regulation on the economy. The experience of individuals and organizations dealing with regulations provides another lens for understanding regulatory effects. And for that, Randy Davis has some valuable insights. But let me just note in closing that the limitations on these annual benefit cost estimates have not hindered their use as an advocacy message. The administration actively promoted the report's estimates for the first 3 years. Comparisons with the Bush administration's first 3 years were cited in the campaign, and even the budget that was released just a few weeks ago touted the net benefits of regulations issued through the third year of the administration. Now that OMB has issued its report on the fourth fiscal year of the administration, I expect we'll hear fewer comparisons.
Mr. Davis, you want to go right ahead with your opening remarks?
Sure, sure. Thank you, and thank you, Susan. It's an honor to follow you. I am Randy Davis, and I am outside counsel to the Business Roundtable, whom I'm appearing on behalf of today. For those of you not familiar with the Business Roundtable, it's an association of chief executive officers of over 200 leading U.S. companies with more than $7.3 trillion in annual revenues and nearly 16 million employees. BRT member companies comprise nearly a third of the total value of the U.S. stock market and invest approximately $150 billion annually in research and development, which is equal to about 61% of U.S. private R&D spending each year. Our members are representative of all sectors of our economy, from manufacturing, energy, telecommunications, financial services, healthcare, insurance, and business services. And for that reason, the breadth of the membership and the fact that it's CEO-led, I think gives us particular insight into the issues of greatest concern to at least large businesses in this country. For the last 10 years, Business Roundtable has conducted quarterly surveys of its CEO members regarding the economic outlook, and many of you may have seen the results of these surveys, which are reported widely and are also posted on the BRT website, www.brt.org. Each December, only once a year, even though this is a quarterly survey, but each December, we include in the questionnaire a question regarding the greatest cost pressure that CEOs face in running their businesses. In the most recent CEO Economic Outlook survey, which was released in December 2012, more than one-third of the Business Roundtable CEOs that responded, which were two-thirds of our member companies, cited regulatory costs as their greatest cost pressure. Other costs cited include labor costs, healthcare costs, pension costs, material costs, litigation, and energy costs. But again, for the first time ever, regulatory cost pressures received far and away the largest number of responses as the greatest concern to the CEOs. Now, within the various sectors, the concern about regulatory costs was particularly intense, meaning a majority of the companies, or a far larger majority of the companies within that particular sector, indicated it as their number one concern. In the transportation, financial services, and energy sectors, where a large majority of respondents cited regulatory costs as their greatest concern. Within the manufacturing sector, concerns about regulatory costs were spread relatively evenly across subsectors, such as chemicals, plastic products, metals, minerals, and miscellaneous motor vehicles, transportation equipment, computers, electronics, and electrical equipment. Within the energy sector, however, regulatory costs were the dominant concern for both utility members and energy extraction companies. So when Susan's work came out analyzing the costs associated with the regulations that have been promulgated over the past year, I guess this, in light of the survey results, this did not come as a particular surprise to us. So armed with this data and this concern, we wanted to try to dig a little bit more deeply into where this concern was really deriving from. In 2010 and again in late 2011 and early 2012, Business Roundtable had already surveyed its members on regulations of particular concern to their business. And from these surveys, we developed a list of 65 different existing, proposed, or anticipated regulations of greatest concerns. And again, this is also posted on the BRT website, www.brt.org. And while this list is somewhat dated at this point, because it's now getting close to 2 years old, we think it's still a fairly good list for determining where this concern about greatest cost pressure is derived. And so what we did is we took the list of 65 different regulations that have been identified in the 2010, 11, and 12 surveys, and then matched that up with the business sectors that felt most intensely that that regulatory costs were their greatest burden. Not surprisingly, a number of EPA regulations emerged at the top. For example, the Industrial Boiler Act, EPA assessment of chemical risk, the particulate matter, PM, National Ambient Air Quality Standard, EPA definition of solid waste, conflict mineral disclosure rule coming out of the SEC, were all fairly likely candidates of as contributing to the concern that these sectors had. With respect to the financial services sector, it also did not take a lot of analysis to figure out that the Dodd-Frank bill and the slew of regulations that are required to be proposed and finalized under that law, including the Volcker Rule, the OTC derivatives rules, capital requirements and surcharges, as well as limits on bank service charge to merchants, we're driving that concern. And so we are still in the process of matching up these specific regulations, but we think that we have a pretty good idea of what's generating the concern, and it's just a whole suite of regulations. It's not necessarily one regulations, but it's a suite of regulations that are driven by the Affordable Care Act, a suite of regulations that's driven by Dodd-Frank, and in the case of EPA, it's just an activist EPA that finally has a mandate to finalize some regulations that were not finalized in the Bush administration, as well as to extend their regulatory authority into areas like hydraulic fracturing and more aggressively pursuing the renewable fuels mandate. So, again, I think the survey results that we had and the work that we did in terms of identifying specific regulations of concern, I think dovetails quite nicely and is a supporting data point to the work that Susan has done and to the fact that rather than being a dying concern or a lesser concern, that the cost of regulations is a very high concern. And while a number of expensive regulations have been finalized, if you look at the regulatory agenda and you look at issues that we know are coming that are not yet on the regulatory agenda, we fully expect that the costs associated with regulations are going to be much higher than the regulations that have already been finalized, which OMB identified and which Susan analyzed. And so with that, Dean, I think that covers what I wanted to cover in my opening remarks.
Terrific. Thank you very much. I want to come back to you, Susan Dudley, but let me start the process of opening the floor for questions first. So in a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, our phone lines are open. If you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone, and we'll come to you momentarily. Before we do that, Susan, I'm going to give you a chance to add to your opening remarks if there's anything additional you want to say after having heard from Randy Davis.
First, thank you, Randy. I thought it was very interesting the specific types of regulations that your members have identified. So I'll just repeat something I mentioned in passing, that regulations under the Dodd-Frank Act are not captured for the most part in OMB's estimates, because those are issued by agencies that are considered independent regulatory agencies, are not subject to OMB's review, and therefore not included in OMB's tally. Also, a lot of the regulations under the Affordable Care Act are not included because HHS does not estimate both the benefits and the costs. So I think given what Randy has said the Business Roundtable's concerns are, OMB's estimates really barely capture it. They would capture EPA regulations for the most part.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And I think in particular when one looks at Dodd-Frank, almost all of those regulations are outside the purview of OMB and will not be captured. And so some of these are extremely costly with de minimis benefits, but unfortunately many of them were also required by Congress.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to the audience now. Again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and the pound button on our telephone. We have one question and then our lines are open. Let's go to our first caller.
Yes, hi. This is Leo Dombrowski in Chicago. I have a question about the claimed net benefits of air regulations. We know, because we can measure and quantify, that the air quality in the United States has improved considerably over the past 20 or 30 years. We've had huge reductions in emissions of particulate matter, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, et cetera. We're never going to get them down to zero, but they've been driven down significantly. And my guess is that we have already experienced large reductions in premature mortality and have already experienced a significant increase in health benefits from the improving air quality. Is anyone, and I know when EPA comes out with regulations, they try to justify them by claiming these large reduction or these large reductions in mortality, et cetera. And that's got to be very vague how they do that, and they put whatever dollar amount on the human life that they do. But has anyone compared the claimed net benefits of the Obama air regulations versus what EPA has claimed in the past? My guess is that, for example, if the claimed net benefits of the Obama air regulations are X, that the regulations in the past, those benefits have to be something like 25X or 50X or some huge multiple of what the Obama administration is claiming.
Well, that is an excellent point. And I think there are several aspects of that, because you're right. When we're looking at, we're predicting benefits of regulations in the future, it's always based on modeling. And one of the problems is that there's really no clear reason for why we would cause a link between what were the reductions in pollution and the health benefits that are being predicted. But indeed, there was a change in 2009 or 2010 to the way benefits were calculated that dramatically increases the benefits available to be achieved from reducing particulate matter. It's the way that the modeling was done. And that has not been applied retrospectively. So that alone would account for very large benefits that you'd get today simply because we're making different assumptions. We have several studies on our website that address that issue, the George Washington University Regulatory Study Center. It's an issue I'm very interested in. Can we look back and do a reality check to see are we really achieving the benefits that we're predicting? So we're working on that. And we're actually working on a conference in September with several very interesting papers, I think. So I'd love to talk to you more offline about that, too.
Susan, you may also want to talk about the double counting of PM benefits that some people are claiming as well, which I think is a related issue.
Well, and I am not sure that there is double counting of the PM benefits. What we're seeing is we get PM benefits by setting a standard that is expressly aimed at reducing PM. But then we also get PM benefits.
PM is particulate matter.
I'm sorry, particulate matter. So I called it fine particles in my, yes. So we also get benefits from things like EPA's mercury standard,
right,
which the public announcements about it were that it was reducing mercury that affects children's IQ, which mercury does. But the reductions were so minuscule that they're, I'm going to forget the data, but I think it was like 0.02 change in IQ points for the most affected children. So the benefits, the actual benefits for mercury reduction were very slim, but there are these ancillary benefits.
Right.
Because you're also reducing particulate matter. And there's a question there of whether is there double counting or is it simply because with the co-benefits, it's what EPA calls co-benefits, if we're reducing below levels that EPA has determined are safe. Determined are safe under a statute that does not allow it to consider the cost of achieving the standard. So safe with an adequate margin of safety, and yet the benefits are counted for going well below what is considered safe with an adequate margin of safety. I'm very skeptical of those claims and agree that we should be.
Susan, this is Dean Reuter. Let me ask a very basic question, and that is the cost-benefit analysis, I take it, is going on at the agency level. That is, the EPA is doing its own cost-benefit analysis. There's some sort of review of that. How meaningful is the review that's done by OMB? And is there concern that an agency like EPA or any other agency, even if it's honestly engaged in cost-benefit analysis, is not the best entity to judge the value of its own work, although their own judgment, like an employee, for example, a year-end evaluation, the employee's own estimation of his relative worth to an organization might be a component of a year-end evaluation, but it's not the beginning and end of it. So maybe you could talk about that if you would.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and it's the employee's self-evaluation, but it's not even a year-end evaluation. It's a self-evaluation at the beginning of the year of what you're going to do, so it's even a step further removed from the year-end evaluation. OMB, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs within OMB, does review these regulations, and they review the regulatory impact analyses too. But that's always the results of that review is always subject to discussion and negotiation between the agency and OMB. And in the end, agencies never take all of OMB's suggestions. And yet, in its annual report to Congress, OMB can't go back. And this is understandable. The president's staff cannot go say, well, we issued this regulation and we reported that the benefits would be $100 or $90 billion a year, but actually, we were wrong because we really didn't believe the agency when they submitted those benefits estimates. OMB always reports the estimates that were published in the agency's rule. Does that...
That does answer the question. One brings up another question I have, though. The OIRA involvement, is that for all agencies or for cabinet-level agencies only? How does it relate to independent agencies?
It's for all executive branch agencies. So that would mean all the cabinet departments, but also executive branch agencies like EPA. They're not part of a department.
But not independent regulatory agencies.
Right. So it would not include the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Right.
Et cetera.
Good. All right. Well, we've got two questions pending from our audience. If you want to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Hi, I'm Matthew Schmidt. I'm a law student at Columbia. This is not a particularly insightful question, but I wondered, Mr. Davis, just to concretize this for the uninitiated, if you might sort of describe maybe three new particularly expensive regulations that your members are complaining about. I think that might help me put some of this in context. Thanks.
Okay. I'm not sure with your question if you're talking about new regulations that are proposed, that we anticipate being proposed, or what we're talking about. But let me give you the number one expensive regulation that actually OIRA and the president turned back to EPA, but it will be repromulgated probably 2014, and that deals with the ozone National Ambient Air Quality Standard. Now, Susan has talked a lot about the cost-benefit analysis, and under the proposal that EPA put out in support of its proposed ozone rule, they had costs under one of the options that ran up to $90 billion a year. Okay, and that was not our estimate; that was their estimate. That was for the most stringent standard. That they had asked comments on. And so in terms of just sheer expense, I think the ozone rule, because ozone is ubiquitous and every metropolitan area needs to worry about it, and also, as one of the previous questioners mentioned, that you know, we've been at this for a long time. We've been regulating air quality since the 70s, and we're now getting down to the point where we're approaching background levels in certain areas of the country. And so the costs for the remaining amount of reduction in ozone and some other pollutants is going to get increasingly expensive. So So in terms of concern, once that proposed rule comes out, I think it will be the number one concern of the business community, simply because the threat of throwing, you know, if you don't meet a standard, you fall into a category called non-attainment, and no one really wants to be non-attainment for a particular national ambient air quality standard, because it is very difficult to expand a facility in that area without coming up with offsets. It's very difficult to site a new facility. It's just very difficult to do business if you're into an area that falls into a non-attainment status. And so every time we ratchet down a standard, the probability is that more and more areas will be out of compliance and therefore have to take extraordinary measures to come into compliance or into attainment, which means greater regulation at the state level in terms of what you can and cannot do in these specific areas. So in terms of the number one concern on the horizon, that would have to be my number one concern. I think the business community in general, shares that concern. You know, the other issues are more sector specific. The reason I picked ozone is it's pretty much ubiquitous. Anybody who manufactures anything, will have this issue. Anybody that transports anything, uses motor vehicles, it's a concern that everyone shares, I believe. Susan, would you agree with that?
Yes. Yeah, I think that is a probably the most high impact rule coming up. From EPA, certainly.
Certainly, yeah.
Let's go to another question.
You have the floor.
Oh, this is Wallace DeWitt from the Committee on Capital Markets Regulation in Cambridge. Professor Dudley mentioned shortly before that the independent financial regulatory agencies, SEC, CFTC, the various banking agencies, are not currently subject to review by OMB and OIRA. There are a couple of bills in the House and Senate, particularly one, a bipartisan one, between Senators Warner and Portman, which have suggested that a consistent approach to the independent regulatory agencies be adopted, an approach consistent, that is, with the executive agencies. I'd be curious to hear the speaker's thoughts on such an idea and whether they think it would materially improve the level of cost-benefit analysis done under particularly Dodd-Frank.
I guess I'll start. I can start, Randy. Yes, I do think that it would. I think it's probably a necessary step, maybe not sufficient, but independent agencies, really, there really are no checks on the regulations they issue and no accountability for making sure that they look first at what the likely costs and benefits will be. Now, the courts have provided some check recently with SEC and CFTC, sending regulations back because they didn't adequately consider what the impacts would be. And actually, the Administrative Conference of the United States right now is developing recommendations for independent agencies for the kinds of regulatory impact analysis they should do, the benefits, analyzing the benefits and costs. So I think that would be very important. I've written on that too and would support that as a measure of accountability. Now, when I say it's necessary but not sufficient, I think there also need to be other checks on not only independent agencies but executive branch agencies. And I would love to see Congress have some kind of an ability to oversee and evaluate agencies' regulatory impact analyses. The way the Congressional Budget Office serves as a check against OMB's budget estimates, I think having something like that for regulatory analysis would be valuable both to Congress and the public.
Yeah, the only thing I would add is that all of the executive orders, and it seems like every president issues one or modifies the way cost-benefit or review of regulations is done, none of them apply to independent regulatory agencies. So as Susan indicated, there is no real coordination or requirement that most of these agencies adhere to any standard analysis of the impact of their regulations unless there's a statutory basis otherwise provided. And so the interesting legal question that I have is whether or not the administration could try to exercise this authority in the absence of new congressional legislation. And it's not abundantly clear to me that the administration could not do that.
This is Wallace DeWitt again. I from what I understand, the executive orders from the Reagan administration to the present have refrained from applying the orders to the independent agencies out of deference to Congress, but that all the administrations have agreed that they do have the authority to do so if they chose.
Yes, that's my understanding too.
Yeah, that's mine too, that there have been legal opinions that they could.
Well, this is Dean Reuter again. Even if there is no standardized cost-benefit analysis in independent agencies, is it the case that each independent agency is engaging in some form of cost-benefit analysis, or are they just regulating without consideration of the costs or the benefits? That seems implausible, but that's the question.
Well, you know, they are very resistant to any kind of a mandate that would require them to. So I think certainly they, if there are burdens imposed under the, like compliance burdens that require collection of information or reporting, they do have to do analysis of that statutorily under the Paperwork Reduction Act, and OIRA reviews that. So I would say that at least the independent agencies are looking at those kinds of costs. I think beyond that, there really is very little.
All right. If you have a question for either of our experts, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have one question pending, then our lines will be open. Star button and then pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Gerard Lehman, Boston Chapter. A very similar question to the one just posed. I think there's a difference, however, and it's this. Is there a standards document much more like the sort of a federal rules of evidence for OIRA in particular, or this kind of analysis generally? The difference I'd see is those inputs which an agency could rely on, whether they sort of elevate up to a forensic standard. So even if there isn't guidance or standard on approach, is there at least something that says what qualified evidence would be? Thanks.
Yes, there are presidential executive orders that discuss rather generally what those standards are. But then OMB also has issued a circular that is rather a thorough set of standards for conducting regulatory impact analysis.
I'm sorry, is it that circular A4
regulatory? Yes, it is.
So I'm trying to get that to launch, and I can't seem to do it. I don't know what that says about the White House website, but thank you.
So A4 is rather long. There's an A4 primer that OMB more recently released that summarizes what should be included in that. Also, I wrote a primer on regulation, which is available at Amazon, but also free download from my website that has a chapter on doing regulatory analysis.
Let me make a final call for questions here. If you want to ask a question of either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if there is a final question, let me make an announcement about our upcoming Teleforum conference calls. We have a call scheduled tomorrow in which we'll be discussing the Boston terrorist attacks and strategic intelligence. That's 2 p.m. tomorrow. We'll welcome a best-selling author and expert, Andy McCarthy, again discussing the Boston terrorist attacks. 2 p.m. tomorrow at this same number. It's 2 p.m. Eastern time. Looks like we've exhausted the questions from the audience. Before we adjourn, I want to give each of you a chance to express any final thoughts, maybe repeat the websites on which some of this information and some additional information could be found. Why don't we start with you, Professor Dudley?
Okay, thanks, Dean. I think this call has been interesting, and I really do think that the Randy's reporting on what the CEOs see as the real-world impact of this. It's interesting that it dovetails so well with the results of the regulations that we're seeing, or the estimates of the effect of the regulations that we're seeing. The Regulatory Study Center at George Washington University, we're devoted to improving regulatory policy by research like this. And so I would welcome people to visit the site. We have a weekly regulation digest, if you're interested in subscribing to that, that reports on not just what we're working on, but all the regulatory activity in Washington. My colleague Sophie Miller reads the Federal Register, so you don't have to. So I would welcome people to come and visit the site and give me a call if you're interested in the work that we're doing.
Before we turn to Randy Davis, it looks like we have another caller question. So let's turn back to the audience if we could.
Hi there. My name is David Smith, and I'm a student at Georgetown here in D.C. And I was wondering if there has been any substantial work done to look at EPA's past cost analysis and compare it to what the rules have actually cost in the present day. Any look-back analysis?
There has been some. It tends to be more anecdotal. And you would think it would be much easier to estimate the costs looking back than it's easier than estimating what the costs will be going forward. But it's still difficult because it's hard to establish what the world would have been if not for these regulations, how much of these costs were imposed as a result of the regulations versus other things. So, no, it's... I think that's something that would be very important to do, but there are really it's rather sparse. The Small Business Administration, the Office of Advocacy, does do a report every several years on what on estimates of the cost of regulation. They don't look at the benefits, just the costs. And so I could refer you to their analysis. That's in the trillions. It's close to $2 trillion is their estimate of the total cost, not just EPA.
This is Randy Davis speaking on behalf of the Business Roundtable, and we have tried to extract this type of information from our members. And, you know, once companies start spending money, it is information that they tend to treat as fairly proprietary information. And so we have not found it easy to get actual data from our CEOs about the cost of regulations. Because even with a pledge of confidentiality and putting all of the information together so that no one company is clearly identified, there's a great reluctance to divulge that information.
There used to be a report that I think was done in collaboration between EPA and the census, and I don't think it's being done anymore. Randy, do you remember it, the cost of clean?
I tried
to break down the compliance costs, but I think it ended in the 90s. I don't know. I don't think that's been picked up again, but it could be very valuable. But again, it would be each of these ways of trying to understand the effect of regulation are just different ways of, you know, different proxies. It's going to be impossible to know what their full effects are, either the benefits or the costs. I liken it to the blind men and the elephant. Each of them is looking at it from a different angle, and perhaps if you get them together, you can get a sense of the whole, but no one measure really can.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I thank both Professor Susan Dudley and Randy Davis for joining us today. This has been a fascinating discussion. Again, I urge you to visit the websites of both of these folks. Information, at least on Susan Dudley's website, was circulated in the notice of this call. I also encourage you to visit the Federalist Society's website on executive branch review. Again, I want to invite our audience members to join us for our teleforum call tomorrow, looking at the Boston attacks, the Boston terrorist attacks, and strategic intelligence. That'll be 2 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow at this same number. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.